Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and the technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we're going to dive into a favorite topic here at Live Science, aliens.
There are so many different kinds of extraterrestrials that have been imagined in pop culture and science fiction, from Star Trek to Star Wars to Doctor Who to Alien to E.T. to Mars Attacks to Rick and Morty. And one of the things that scientists, one of the big questions that scientists ask about extraterrestrials is, where are they? There's actually something called the Fermi paradox. This is something that was a question that was asked in the 1950s by an Italian astrophysicist called Enrico Fermi. And basically it goes like this. There are approximately an estimated 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and trillions upon trillions of stars. So it seems unlikely that Earth would be the only place where intelligent life would evolve, right?
Right.
Right. I mean, just because there are so, you know, there, it's like there are so many... Huge potential for life within the universe. But if that's the case, then where is everybody? So this is known as Fermi's paradox. So even though we have not yet discovered anything that could be called a reliable signal or evidence of extraterrestrial life, scientists are looking for signs of extraterrestrials all the time.
And that brings us to our first mystery. How do scientists search for extraterrestrial life?
So what are they looking for?
One of the things they're looking for are radio signals produced by some kind of advanced alien civilization. And a neat thing happened back in 1977. One of these signals was found. A guy named Jerry Amon was at Ohio State University, and he was listening to the skies for some kind of radio signal from extraterrestrial life. And he found something.
And what did he find?
Well, there was apparently this really weird and intense radio signal, and it was a radio burst that lasted for 72 seconds. And on the printout from the computer, from the telescope, he circled the, you know, the letters or whatever that came out that signified the intensity and frequency of that weird burst. And next to it, he wrote, "Wow," with an exclamation point. And since that day, scientists have not been able to replicate that radio burst. They don't know exactly where it came from because they haven't heard it before. But it's referred to as the "Wow" signal.
And radio signals, that's where scientists are focusing a lot of their attention, looking for signs of extraterrestrials, because in the electromagnetic spectrum, radio signals can be detected even if they're very faint and very far away. So that seemed like that's a good place to look for evidence of what might be alien, intelligent alien life.
And since the universe is so big, where, you know, we have these big radio telescopes, where are scientists aiming these telescopes?
Well, one group of scientists with the SETI Institute, that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, and that's a nonprofit. It's a group of it's researchers and educators that are focused on the search for extraterrestrial life. So there is something called the Allen Telescope Array at SETI, or ATA, and this is 42 radio antennas that are listening to regions around 20,000 red dwarf stars that are closest to Earth. Now, many red dwarf stars are known to host planets in the Goldilocks zone, which is it's not too far from the star, not too close to the star. So it's just at the right distance for the star to be habitable. And formerly, these telescopes were actually eavesdropping on stars that were more like our sun, which is a yellow dwarf. Red dwarf stars are smaller and they're cooler, and they're a lot more common than yellow dwarf stars. And so in recent years, those types of stars have been the focus of the search for signals from potential extraterrestrials. So transmissions in this wavelength could be produced deliberately by technology from an advanced extraterrestrial civilization. But there are other explanations for radio noise. It could be made by star flares, other types of background astronomical sources, terrestrial interference from an artificial satellite. So in other words, there's a lot of noise out there. And so the big challenge is trying to find a signal amongst the noise that could actually point to something that's extraterrestrial in origin.
And there's actually a project. It was started in 2015 by a billionaire, Yuri Milner, and $100 million was put toward this 10-year project to scan our galaxy, the Milky Way, and nearby galaxies. And they're looking at both radio signals and optical light, what they call technosignatures. And
so what do optical light signals tell you that radio signals don't?
Optical light signals are very different. They would be some kind of laser light that's produced by this advanced civilization, and it's being used to communicate. So far, the Breakthrough Listen project has come up empty-handed, as many, many alien, you know, looking projects have. But one of the good things is that there's still lots of potential. An astrophysicist at Penn State, Jason Wright, he once calculated that all the SETI searches to date, including this Breakthrough Listen project, which combed through a petabyte of data from more than 1,000 stars, they've basically combed through two hot tubs worth of data in all of the Earth's oceans.
So I guess that's the ray of hope that keeps astrophysicists looking for signals, even after spending so much time and looking in so many places and not finding it, is the fact that the universe is so vast and that the area that is already covered is so small. There's still a really, really good chance that there's something out there in a place we haven't looked at.
Yeah. And when this Breakthrough Listen project was, when it was being announced back in 2015, Stephen Hawking, who was alive then, apparently said, in an infinite universe, there must be other life. There is no bigger question. It is time to commit to finding the answer.
Yeah, so that's the thing, that the idea that extraterrestrials could be out there, even if there hasn't been any direct evidence found yet, there's so many places to look.
And the payoff could be so huge. Can you imagine?
Yeah, exactly. So those aren't the only ways that scientists are looking for aliens. There's also the possibility of finding chemical signals that are produced by microbes. Now, I know like the idea of microbial extraterrestrials maybe doesn't sound as sexy as the
boring.
Kind of, yeah, I know microbes. And I'm sorry to all the scientists out there that study microbes. Of course, microbes are not boring. Microbes are fascinating. But if you have been, you know, if you've grown up and been nurtured on the idea of, you know, of aliens from Star Trek, then the idea of, you know, hey, we found an alien, but it's a microbe, maybe doesn't sound as exciting. But microbes are actually fascinating. And life on Earth, in fact, started as microbes. You and I started as microbes billions and billions of years ago. So the earliest evidence of life on Earth, which dates back to more than 3 billion years ago, is evidence, organic evidence that was left behind by microbes. So first there were microbes, and then microbes over time evolved into multicellular life. And then from that emerged more complex marine creatures. And then from that came the tetrapod body plan, the four-limbed body plan. And then creatures emerged from the oceans and climbed down on land. And then things just radiated outward from there over billions and billions of years to give us the diversity of life that we see today. So microbes are actually really exciting.
Yes, microbes are exciting. They are, but they're not little green aliens. So why not look on other worlds that we've found already, that we've identified?
Well, we should. We absolutely should look on other worlds. There are obviously, you know, there are only so many worlds that are within our reach in terms of being able to observe more directly than looking at distant radio signals. So some of the ideal candidates for this kind of a search are exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars that are in the Goldilocks zone. If they have water, because all life on Earth is associated with the presence of water, and if they are less than 30 light years away, so we could actually get there. Anything that's beyond 30 light years, and a light year is about 5.9 trillion miles. So that's, you know, sort of describing
the limiting factor.
Yeah. So you know, there's only so far that humans can physically travel
right
at this point to, you know, or that we can not that we can physically travel, that we can send spacecraft to observe more directly. So how would we find, you know, those kinds of signals, those kind of chemical traces that are produced by microbes? So you could find them as chemical signals in the atmosphere.
You know, plants on Earth photosynthesize and produce oxygen. So oxygen is one of those elements that we would look for in the atmosphere, or something that is an anomaly that was likely produced by an organic living thing. Some of those sulfur could be one of those chemical signatures we look for. the downside of that is that, you know, other things produce sulfur, like volcanoes.
Right. And of course, you know, the what we know about life is at this point restricted to what we know about life on Earth. And scientists can make, you know, they can look at different forms of life on Earth. And in fact, there are certain types of organisms called extremophiles that exist in very, very extreme environments on Earth, in the depths of the ocean floor, that where they live around hydrothermal vents, and they are
Yosemite with the hot springs,
yes,
and maybe Antarctica under the ice sheet. They've found extreme life that can survive in these harsh, extreme conditions.
Right. So scientists are actually studying these extremophiles on Earth to get a sense of how similar forms of life might weather similar extreme conditions on potentially on other planets. And so there are some local candidates just that are
That's
actually
right.
fairly close by.
Mars and Titan and Europa, the moons of Enceladus, Titan and Europa are places that they're actively searching for signs of life.
Right. Yeah. So at this point in our solar system, any place where there is where there's evidence of water or ice, water ice, or evidence of past water, like on Mars.
And one of my favorite alien discoveries, or, you know, potentially alien discoveries, was discovered in 2015. It's called Tabby Star.
I just love that name.
I love that name.
I love the name Tabby Star.
It's named after the scientist Tabitha Boyajian, who discovered this anomaly, basically. It's 1,400 light years from Earth, and it's in the Cygnus constellation. Basically, Tabitha saw this weird dimming effect around this star. It would get brighter and then dimmer, and there was no regularity to it.
Right. Well, this kind of effect is something that you see, like, let's say if you're looking at a light and you move an object, like, you know, take your hand and move it in front of the light, then it blocks some of the light and the light dims down. So this is actually a way that scientists look for signs of planets orbiting distant stars. They
right.
look to see if there are signatures of, if there are patterns in the light dipping down, because that could indicate that, and if it does that on a regular basis, it could mean that there is a planet or multiple planets that are orbiting around, and as they make their transit, they come between us and the star and they block a little bit of the light. But in this case,
yep.
22% is a lot of blocking. It's like way more than
and
what
it
happened
was,
with the
it wasn't regular. So they could not explain it by some orbiting planet or world. So one of the ideas that was put out there was that it was this alien megastructure.
Right. What could be an alien megastructure?
You know, some huge, I think of some huge spacecraft civilization, that something was built and it was moving in front of this star.
So that was one possible explanation. But was there any direct evidence of such a structure?
There was no direct evidence.
So I mean, it's a great idea.
It is.
It's an interesting idea. And right now there are no feasible explanations for what it could be. That's something that's possible.
It's something that's possible. They have found evidence that there's some weird dust cloud that can at least explain a little bit of the dimming, but the jury's still out. We don't know what's causing the weird dimming around Tabby Star.
But it's not just Tabby Star.
That's right.
So recently they actually found more of these weirdo stars that were doing something similar to what they were seeing in Tabby Star.
Lots of alien megastructures?
Possible alien megastructures. We still don't know for sure. So for now, at least, the paradox that was proposed by Fermi, you know, still holds. That where is everybody? We still haven't really gotten any messages or found any signs of intelligent extraterrestrial cultures or life that is trying to contact us. But
we're still looking.
Yes. So for more than 100 years, science fiction has imagined how humans might interact with intelligent aliens. And you know, from what we've seen in sci-fi, that experience can be either positive or it can be kind of negative.
Some of my favorite negative, on the negative side of the aliens, are the Doctor Who's Daleks. Well, they're not his, but they're so of one mind just to kill everything that's not Dalek. And I just think they're extra creepy.
Yeah, that is pretty negative. So let's say that scientists do discover evidence of intelligent alien life on a distant planet, or, you know, even closer to our own solar system. So what happens next?
Well, that brings us to our second mystery, which is, if we discover aliens, what's our protocol for making contact?
In 1950, the U.S. military apparently developed a plan for how they would go about going through the stages of, you know, what they would do if they discovered some form of intelligent alien life, either here on Earth or elsewhere. And so because this was a plan that was put together by the U.S. military, this is something that was not widely available to the public and was actually first, it actually first became more widely known when it was written about in a book that was published in 1967 called Flying Saucers Here and Now by Frank Edwards. So phase one is remote surveillance and data gathering. So that is just about observing from a distance, not making any kind of overtures, and staying hidden.
So they're doing all this. This is like arm's length from these possible extraterrestrial intelligence. Was there any plan to actually go and visit?
That comes in good time. So yes, that's something that was actually phase two, covert visitations.
Of course.
So that's getting, you know, getting a little more up close. The surveillance in phase one was remote surveillance. And this is actually physically, you know, if possible, physically visiting the location where the aliens are found to gather more information.
I definitely picture the military on their hands and knees crawling up to this possible extraterrestrial life, but it's probably not on Earth.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, as far as there's no evidence that any phase of this plan was ever carried out. So although, you know, the U.S. military's history with extraterrestrials and UFOs obviously goes way back, and that will probably be the subject of another episode for us. But as far as in the 1950s, whether or not anyone actually walked through all of or any of these phases, I think is, you know, is something that we certainly don't know now. Phase three is covert contact. And I'm quoting from the document here. So this was intended to check the performance characteristics of vehicles belonging to the planetary inhabitants to test their speed, types of propulsion, and maneuverability as compared to our own. So it's a level of contact that is still not directly approaching any extraterrestrials. It's more to get a sense of what type of technology they have and
to drive their cars.
Drive their cars, fly their spaceships, use their jetpacks, whatever it is that they're using. Again, this is the 1950s.
Right.
So the popular perception of extraterrestrials then was, you know, somewhat different than it is now.
So what's next after testing out their technology?
Well, okay, so that's just still just checking out their technology. It's not actually, I don't think anyone's talking about actually trying to hijack any spaceships or steal any of these alien craft. It's more just focusing specifically on
the technology.
That aspect of their technology, right? So the next step, phase five, is brief touchdowns in isolated areas to collect specimens of plants, animals, and if possible, specimens of the intelligent beings themselves. So I believe the idea is that it very much sounds like they were describing finding a world where there were alien communities, alien civilizations established, and how contact would go that way. However, it's also possible that this is describing, you know, if aliens had landed on Earth and perhaps established a community of their own, maybe bringing their technology, bringing plants or animals from their home planet, that they would be approached in the same way as they would be approached if we were going directly to their world. I know, it's like there aren't a lot of details
on this. Really, yeah.
They didn't spell it out. But
collecting samples sounds like a smart idea.
Right. So then after that is phase six. Again, quoting from the document, if we decide that the evidence seems to warrant some kind of eventual contact, direct or indirect, then phase six would consist of landings and low-level approaches where our craft and their operators could be seen, but not reached. So it's a little bit of a tease. So if you get to phase six, then you want to let them know that they're being observed, but not in such a way that they could actually contact us.
There's got to be, what is phase seven, the actual contact?
That's, well, since there are only seven phases, yeah, there's really only one thing left after that. So after you've kind of done all this observation from a distance.
All this probing.
All this, right, probing and sampling and actually, you know, showing them like, hey, here we are. Then obviously the final stage, the only one that's left, is making direct contact and trying to communicate.
And do they say how they would communicate?
No, of course not. At least, or I don't know. Maybe they discussed it amongst themselves in top secret meetings, but that information was not revealed to the public.
That is so interesting, and it didn't stop there.
this conversation and this plan did not begin and end with the 1950s, and that
turns out it did not.
Yes. Okay. So then where did it go from there?
So in 1991, the SETI Institute created the Declaration of Principles for Activities Following the Detection of Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
So how is this different from the way the military did it?
Well, for one, they involved other groups. This was approved by the International Institute of Space Law, the International Astronomical Union, which is the one that, you know, approves the planet names, et cetera, and the Committee on Space Research, as well as the International Union of Radio Science. And a lot of this, at least a good chunk of it, seems to circle around how to tell the public, how to like release this crazy, you know, seemingly crazy discovery.
Well, which in and of itself is a, you know, big improvement over the way the military does it, because for the military, it's all about secrecy. It's all about keeping it within the military, keeping everything concealed, keeping everything quiet. And it seems like this is a step towards
public announcement of this and sharing the news and this amazing finding, if it ever happens. And so the first part of this would be to verify this signal, you know, verify that where it's coming from, you know, like the WOW signal, which they verified, but they haven't been able to replicate.
But also just making sure that it is actually of extraterrestrial origin, or that it seems.
Right. It's not a satellite. It's not something else that's causing interference. Once they do that, the SETI Institute, or the committee for SETI, would communicate with the other signatories of the declaration. And that would all happen before making this public.
So even though ultimately the goal is to share this information, there are still reasonable steps that have to be gone through.
They're vetting all of the information to make sure it's legit before they even tell the public. And once they determine that this is credible, this is a credible extraterrestrial signal, they then were to inform the astronomical community. And they would do this through the Central Bureau of Astronomical Telegrams. And that was part of the International Astronomical Union.
But it's not just astrophysicists that are being notified about it at this
point. Exactly. They would also let the Secretary General of the United Nations know, and other global scientific unions.
Which makes sense. I mean, you know, this is something, you know, contact with extraterrestrials is something that could potentially have repercussions for the whole planet.
Right. And you'd want input from all kinds of experts, or all kinds of astronomical experts. And so following that, their idea is that this news should be made public.
Right. Because, you know, people should, well, It's all very well and good to say that, you know, the public should be informed and the public should know about this. But also, you know, as we can certainly see from what happens on social media, the way that news spreads, you know, stories can be, you know, shaped by misinformation.
And once that gets spread, there's no going back, really. So
right. It's really hard to kind of get people back on track once, you know, bad information is already out there. So that's why, you know, so all these organizations have to make sure that the information that they're releasing to the public, that they are all sending the same message, and that people are being informed about, you know, what's actually happening.
And one of the interesting things about this document, or this agreement, this declaration that's different from the military one, is there's a big do not respond. Doing so requires international agreement under separate procedures.
Right. No, they come right out and say that. So if you happen to be either, you know, you're a private citizen, or you're part of one of these organizations, and you are one of the first to actually detect some evidence of what might be an intelligent extraterrestrial, don't do anything. Just really don't do anything.
There's no going up and saying hello. You have to follow certain procedures. And
right. Well, don't do anything. You have to. Yeah, obviously, you have to follow all of these guidelines. But don't do anything as far as actually trying to reach out and contact them on your own. Just no, don't do that. Now, obviously, there will be some type of response, but that is something that will be crafted most likely by groups of informed experts, astrophysicists from all of these different international committees and groups, to make sure that we are sending the right kind of message. And so all of these guidelines are continually reviewed by committees in the IAA and the IAU. And so as far as anything related to detecting extraterrestrial intelligence or managing data related to these discoveries,
has to go through a vetting process and be approved.
Exactly. And just because, so these new guidelines, so the first set of guidelines was from the 1950s. This was put together in the 1990s. And essentially, these guidelines are still the ones that are followed today. but or that would be followed if
right.
if there were some contact with extraterrestrials, which it does not appear that there has been, because I do not recall seeing any announcement by the United Nations that we have made such contact, which would be part of the process. But nevertheless, as technologies change and as things, you know, things move forward in the area of searching for extraterrestrial life, these guidelines are constantly being reviewed, and all of the data gathering and what we know about the possibility of extraterrestrial life is being factored in to see if any of these need to be changed or updated.
So most of us are stuck at home right now.
But there's something you can do that will feed your curiosity and expand your horizons, and that is trying something called the Great Courses Plus.
With thousands of lectures, the Great Courses Plus is such a nice way for us and for everyone to stay informed and engaged right now.
Right. You can delve into so many different topics. You can learn about the science of Earth and the planets. You can learn about psychology, philosophy. You can also improve your own skills or indulge in personal interests or find new hobbies.
Specifically right now, the Great Courses Plus is a great way to understand our current situation with these fact-based courses. For instance, they have a course called An Introduction to Infectious Diseases, which is a way for anyone to learn more about viruses, the science of viruses, about vaccines, about how diseases transmit between people.
Right. And you know, let's say your interests are more on the economics end of things. There's a course called Money and Banking, What Everyone Should Know. And that is a great way to help understand what's happening in the stock market right now. And then there are also courses that you can use as a family. If you're looking for a way to keep your kids learning about math or to get them more excited about science or history while they're out of school and they're at home, there are courses that can do that, too.
You also can switch between courses. So if you're, you know, doing a hobby course such as learning about gardening, you don't have to finish that course. You can stop it there and toggle to another course and toggle back and forth between the two.
Right.
And you can also download these. So if, you know, especially I think if lots of people in the house are using the internet, just download it and then you will have no interruptions. You can listen anytime.
And the Great Courses Plus has a great offer to get you started. So right now, they're giving our listeners a special limited time offer of a free month of unlimited access to the entire library. But to get this offer, you need to sign up now through our special URL.
Start your free month today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM. That's LLM for Life's Little Mysteries. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM.
In California, an agency called the Search for Intelligent Extraterrestrials Institute, or SETI, has conducted research investigating the origins and nature of life in the universe since 1984. And it also provides resources for public education about identifying signals that could point towards advanced alien civilizations. Here to talk to us about that is Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer and institute fellow with the SETI Institute. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
As an introduction to our listeners, what do you do at the SETI Institute?
Well, I work as the senior astronomer here at the SETI Institute in the Silicon Valley of California. And the SETI Institute is interested in the whole question of life beyond Earth.
Tell me about the signals that are investigated at SETI. What are the best candidates for finding communications from intelligent extraterrestrials?
We're looking for life in our own solar system. A lot of the scientists here do that. And, of course, they can do that on the basis of data that can be collected by actual, you know, expeditions, if you will, not human expeditions, but robotic expeditions to these worlds like Mars and eventually the moons of the outer solar system. But in terms of intelligent extraterrestrial life, we do, in fact, look for signals. Now, we haven't picked up any signals yet that we thought were definitely, you know, produced extraterrestrially by some transmitter. That's what we're looking for. And of course, if we were to find that, everybody would know. But until now, we have not found such signals. We look for what are called narrow band signals. So those are signals that are at one spot on the radio dial, because those are the signatures, the technical signatures, if you will, of somebody who's built a transmitter and obviously somebody who's intelligent enough to build a transmitter.
And what is it about radio signals that makes that the part of the electromagnetic spectrum that gets the most attention?
We look for radio signals because radio waves pass through the gas and dust that hangs between the stars. So they go everywhere. it sounds like a bumper sticker or something. But in fact, that's one advantage of them. The other thing is they're very easy to produce. And you can carry a fair amount of information on a radio signal. Just consider, your television set or your FM radio or whatever. So we figure that no matter what else aliens might be doing, they're going to make use of the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum. They're going to do that. And so since they're easy to detect and since we have very sensitive equipment, we've opted to mostly do radio, not exclusively, but mostly.
I was wondering if you could maybe walk me through the process of elimination when a signal comes in. So what's the checklist of things that you rule out? Like, here's what the signal definitely is not, so you can figure out what it is.
We pick up signals all the time. This is somewhat different than what you see in the movies, where people doing SETI experiments are sitting around looking bored, maybe having a drink, a smoke, practicing their putting, whatever they're doing. And then suddenly a big spike appears on a display, or they start hearing a strange noise in their headphones or something like that. And they get all excited. And sure enough, it's the aliens on the line. Well, of course, it doesn't work that way. We have the computers doing the listening, not humans. We monitor 72 million channels simultaneously. You really can't have humans doing that. And so we pick up these signals, but picking up a signal is something that happens several times a minute. The question is it an extraterrestrial signal, or is it just from, a radar installation 50 miles away? Or, much more likely, is it just a telecommunications satellite or some satellite that's in orbit around the Earth? There are thousands of those. And, of course, they all send information, if they're working, they all send information back to Earth. And those signals we pick up, and we have to sort those out. We do that on the basis of, big databases of known interference, but also seeing if the signal moves across the sky at the rate that a satellite will do. Anybody who's seen satellites at night knows that they pirouette across the sky in about 20 minutes. So anything that does that is clearly a satellite and not ET.
One of the other things that SETI was involved in the 1990s was setting up a list of guidelines for what would be done under circumstances of making some kind of contact. And since then, have those guidelines been reevaluated, or have they been updated to reflect new technologies or any new protocols for making contact?
Yeah, there is a set of protocols. It dates from the 1980s, actually. And in fact, these protocols, which were sort of best practices of what to do in case you pick up a signal, were motivated by the Cold War, because the Soviet Union and the United States both had SETI experiments. And the thought was, well, you don't want one side or the other to think that if the opposite side were the first to pick up a signal, that they somehow would monopolize that information. It was just to avoid possible bad blood. Now, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually, this is no longer particularly relevant, but in fact, it wasn't terribly practical in any case. I was in charge of the International Commission that revisited the protocols, and we cleaned them up and avoided some of the logical inconsistencies and so forth. But basically, what they say is, if you find a signal, check it out, announce it to the world, and don't send anything back without international consultation. I can tell you that we've had a couple of false alarms that looked pretty good for a while, and those put these protocols to the test, if you will. And what you find out is that they're not terribly useful. In fact, what really happens in case of a signal detection is that the media are immediately bombarding you with questions, calling up and wanting to know what's going on.
And now moving forward, does it seem like parts of these guidelines need to change to address that? And how would that even happen?
Yeah, I don't think that changing the protocols is of terribly much benefit. Nobody seems interested in doing it. As noted, what actually happens if you find a signal is that you start checking it to make sure that you're not being fooled by, some sort of terrestrial interference or even a prank. It could be. That'd be pretty hard, but maybe it could be done. So you're going to spend a couple of days checking it. And in all that time, the media will be all over the story. We know that. It's happened several times. So that's what actually happens, and the protocols are of a limited benefit.
So at this point, there have been decades devoted to listening to signals from space. And as you said, there were some that seemed like pretty good leads, but then ultimately they didn't pan out. Do you and other astronomers working on this get discouraged ever? And what keeps you hopeful about one day finding a signal that does provide definitive proof of intelligent extraterrestrials?
Yeah, we haven't found the aliens yet. That's a fact. And, you know, this experiment has been going on and off ever since 1960. The lack of money is a serious problem. There's no government money for doing this, so it's all private donations that fund SETI in this country. And the United States at the moment is actually the only country doing SETI. So it's a very, very limited experiment, and that's a problem. But we don't get discouraged. To begin with, we, you know, have learned that planets are very commonplace in the universe, in the Milky Way galaxy, which is our galaxy. There are like a trillion planets, and that's just our galaxy. We can see trillions of other galaxies. So there's a lot of real estate. It would be astounding if it's all sterile. That just doesn't seem to make too much sense. So we figured they're out there. I think that what keeps the people who do this going is the rapid improvement in the technology that's being used for the search. So it's, you know, the search keeps getting sped up all the time and very rapidly. So I think that that's, you know, that's the carrot hanging in front of our nose.
I've been talking to Seth Shostak, senior astronomer with the SETI Institute. You can read more about his outreach in the Live Science article, Is It Time to Rethink How We Search for Alien Life? The link is in the show notes. Seth, thanks so much for talking to us.
Terrific, Mindy. Thank you so much.
We've been talking about how humanity is listening for radio signals and other signs of alien life. But Live Science reporter Stephanie Pappas recently talked to some researchers who are looking into the possibility of ET bugging a space rock to listen in on Earthlings. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for joining us. So you recently wrote about a pretty bizarre idea about aliens spying on us. That's fascinating to think about. Who dreamed that up?
So the idea that aliens might be spying on us came from James Binford. He's a physicist, and he's been involved in SETI research, that's search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for a long time. And, you know, it sounds a little bit far out, but Binford is a, you know, valuable, respected member of this community. And one thing that SETI researchers value is thinking outside the box. So this idea has gotten some interest in the community.
And how did he come up with that idea?
So Binford came up with the idea that aliens could have bugged Earth while he was listening to a conference talk. And he was just kind of letting his mind wander. And he was thinking about these co-orbitals. And these are little bits of something. We actually haven't really explored them. Presumably they're space rocks. But Binford makes the point that, heck, maybe they're alien technology, we really don't know. And these are objects that kind of orbit in strange patterns near Earth. So they're always nearby. Certainly some of them can hang around Earth for up to centuries, but maybe longer.
Okay, so they orbit with Earth around the sun.
Yeah, so they're orbiting in sort of non-elliptical patterns around the sun, but in an orbit that keeps them close to Earth.
And how would Binford or other physicists in this field go about searching for these co-orbitals? And what actually would they be looking for?
The co-orbitals are within reach. If we wanted to search and learn more about what was there, it would be fairly easy to send a probe. And in fact, China's space agency would like to send a probe to one co-orbital that's nicknamed Earth's closest companion. And so going there and checking out these objects for perhaps alien technology or some sort of non-natural object that could be placed there would be fairly easy.
So these are called technosignatures, and these are different from how the SETI Institute and SETI scientists generally listen for signs of alien life, right?
For a long time, the idea with SETI was to mostly listen, sometimes send out, you know, the famous disc with the picture of the male and female body and just hope maybe someone would pick that up. But largely it was about listening. And the idea with the co-orbitals is, you know, aliens may not be separated from us by space as much as by time, because the universe has been around for billions of years. There could have been intelligent life that lived and maybe even went extinct before humanity showed up. So if there was a super intelligent species out there that noticed there was some, say, blue-green algae on Earth and thought, yeah, we'll keep an eye on this, their technology might theoretically still be around, even if that society is long gone.
I love how in your article, Benford calls this extraterrestrial archaeology because it's sort of digging up the past.
Yes, it's looking in the past, hoping that something happened long before we got here. It is extraterrestrial archaeology.
And so practically speaking, Stephanie, how likely is it that this bugged space rock would be circling in one of these co-orbitals or would be a co-orbital?
Right now, we don't know a lot about the likelihood that a co-orbital would be a good place for an alien bug. That's mainly because we don't know much about co-orbitals. We don't even know how long they stay near Earth. If it turns out that these orbits only keep them near Earth for a century or two, that's a lot less promising. But if they turn out to stay for, you know, millions of years, that could be a lot more interesting.
Are colleagues in the field taking Benford's idea seriously? Do they have anything to say about it?
So Benford is working with some colleagues right now to look at the possibility of pinging co-orbitals with planetary radar, maybe learning more about any sort of signals that might bounce back. Perhaps the Society of Aliens could have put something capable of responding on one of these rocks. And another idea that has been pursued is looking at the high-resolution images from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, checking out the surface of the moon. Now, probably we've got a pretty good handle on a lot of the surface of the moon, but if there's something small there, the researchers would want to be able to look at these high-resolution images to see it.
That's a really interesting idea, looking at the moon for this alien spyware. And if the search comes up empty, what then?
Well, if the search were to come up empty, it would perhaps be a bit of a disappointment. It would mean that no one has been watching us, and no one's been watching us for a very long time. So that would mean that this idea of extraterrestrial archaeology has not really borne any fruit.
Okay, so I guess we're back to the Fermi paradox. Where are all the aliens?
That's back to square one, and it's back to the Fermi paradox over a long time period. You've come up with a way to look back in time, and it hasn't worked out.
Thanks so much, Stephanie, for speaking with us about your news article on alien spyware.
Thank you.
You can read Stephanie's article, Could ET Have Bugged a Space Rock to Listen in on Earthlings, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. Since scientists have yet to discover any evidence of extraterrestrial life, artists, filmmakers, and writers have had pretty much, you know, a lot of creative license when it comes to imagining aliens. From the size, shape, skin texture, number of eyes and legs, basically anything goes when it comes to aliens.
Right. So for today's final mystery, we ask, will ET look like us?
If we do find intelligent aliens, what do you think they'll look like?
I grew up watching Star Trek, and of course, the vast majority of the Star Trek aliens are bipedal, humanoid, essentially because it was easier for costumers and art directors to create aliens that, you know, just look like people mostly. But there's no reason to believe that that is actually what they're going to look like. So I don't know. I think I have a fondness for, you know, for Vulcans because of my early exposure to Star Trek, but there are so many different types. If you watch Rick and Morty, there are plenty of aliens on that. Obviously, if you're, you know, for cartoons, you have a lot more leeway in terms of doing some kind of weird body plan and being able to animate it and make it look as real as a person. So
yeah, I think my favorite would have to be E.T. I mean, I just have a fondness for E.T. because I think that's just how I first was the first window for me into the world of extraterrestrials, and E.T. was so sweet.
Yeah, E.T. was very cute. That is true.
But, you know, pop culture has really given us a wide variety of body plans, of skin color, of, you know, limbs, eyes, mouths. But scientists really are looking at questions of what would aliens actually look like. And some scientists look to Darwin for this because, you know,
Darwin didn't talk about extraterrestrials.
He didn't, but Darwin's theory of natural selection does involve how life evolved on Earth, how life adapted to this, the conditions that make the planet habitable for us.
Right, right. So that explains, I mean, obviously, if you look at the diversity of life on Earth, I mean, you have primates and you have jellyfish and you have sea cucumbers and you have parasitic wasps, and there are so many species and so many different kinds of body plans and so many weird specialization. So probably pretty much any kind of weirdness that a science fiction writer could come up with is something that has probably already shown up in some form or another in evolution.
Yeah, totally. And scientists have looked at, you know, how natural selection, you know, might impact the adaptation of alien life. And one of the things one group of scientists came up with was that on Earth, cells join to make multicellular organisms. Multicellular organisms often cooperate in communities, in colonies. And so they actually dreamed up a weird creature that to sort of signify what an alien might look like. And they called it the Octomite. It's this complex creature made up of smaller entities that have sort of aligned their interests so they cooperate in one body. And I mean, it basically looks like a big tardigrade with weird appendages.
Oh, tardigrades are awesome. Tardigrades actually should be extraterrestrials because they are these extreme microscopic creatures that can pretty much survive just about anything.
And they're so cute.
And they're adorable.
They're adorable. We can agree on that.
So, but originally, and this is actually a very widespread idea. It's maybe right now the variety of extraterrestrial forms that we see across pop culture has, you know, given people a lot of different ideas to work with as far as what aliens could look like. But there's one idea that is really, really pervasive and has been for a long time.
Little green men.
Little green men. Yes. This is something that, that I mean, you know, pretty much the, you know, the emoji for aliens is, you know, is often a small green face and
big eyes.
Yeah. And the idea of little green men is just something you say that and people just automatically assume you're talking about aliens. So where did, you know, like where did that idea come from? And how did it, you know, just how did it become this big idea about or this way of generally thinking about aliens?
Well, apparently it dates back to the 12th century, and there's this legend of two kids with green skin appearing in the English village of Woolpit. And I guess that's where some people trace this little green men visual back to.
Right. And then actually this concept came up in science fiction, specifically in a story from 1946 that was called Mayaya's Little Green Men. So that was actually, I think, the first overt science fiction reference. And then, of course, in the sci-fi novel Martians Go Home from 1955, this had invading green men that were kind of pranksters, kind of these annoying little aliens that played a lot of tricks and basically just got people really irritated.
And then later in 1965, we have the Great Gazoo character in The Flintstones.
Right. And he was literally a little green man. He was also kind of annoying.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Well, Toy Story has those little green men, those little green aliens.
Yes, that's right. Which... Yeah, the little aliens that come out of the vending machine.
Yeah.
Yep. So you know, so the idea is still alive and well, and it seems like that's something that is probably not going to go away as much as we have, you know, aliens that are, you know, that are these gaseous clouds or aliens that are made of metal or aliens that even, you know, that even look kind of like people.
So even though we haven't detected any aliens yet, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what they might look like, where we might find them, and we're open to possibilities.
It's still pretty much anyone's guess. I mean, you know, we can, there are, I guess scientists can make good guesses based on what we already know about life on Earth and the variety of forms that life can take based on different environments and different evolutionary pressures. But as far as, you know, what those evolutionary pressures could be shaping life on other worlds, that's still something that is still a very, very big unanswered question.
So they could be little green men or something else.
That is absolutely still a possibility.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's alien mysteries, how do scientists search for extraterrestrial life, If we discover aliens, what's our protocol for making contact? And will ET look like us? Are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in the podcast notes.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.